I'm Charles Breton.
I'm Helena Epstein.
And I'm Chris Henson. Together we are
a Jew
and
a Gentile walking to
a bar
mitzvah.
Welcome in, episode 107. Glad you're with us here at...
I'm glad somebody's keeping track of that. I always... episode are we on?
Yeah, well, I still have a few more toes I can use to count. But this is the podcast where you'll find the theology, the cigars, whiskey, and F-bombs. And besides our website, charlesandchris.net, our podcast is available on Stitcher, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you pretty much you get your...
Theology Corner. I figured that out.
You did.
Hang up there. So we're back up to date. So I still had all their links for Squarespace and there with WordPress now. So that's my fault, but okay. We're back in black.
Business on theologycorner.net.
That's right. Okay.
Also, again, it is official that a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah is part of the Wild Goose Goosecast Network, a network of faith-based podcasts discussing issues of inclusion and social justice. To learn more about the Wild Goose Festival, go to wildgoosefestival.org.
Are we the senior members of that group?
We're certainly one of the founding members of that group.
By age and the fact that we that are still recording?
And that everyone drank my whiskey.
Well, I guess Helena kind of brought the age down, kind of lowered our average.
Yeah,
which is that. The only thing she's lowered on this podcast is the average age.
Yeah, we lower everything else, the intellect, the conversation.
Depth, the whole nine yards.
Rev Honey Bear.
Gotta be good for something.
Yeah, Reverend Honey Bear, the ampersand of reason, keeps us flying Honey straight. Bear.
I do my best.
You do, and it's very good. Mentioning our sponsors, Men of the Beard Beard Oil, and I finally got confirmation from Brandon that they are still making beard oil.
Now you feel shitty about like plugging other beard oils.
Well, I didn't
now.
Plug it. I was lamenting that I had to spend money, and I mean, I like their other products, the Wet Shaving Company. I've been using their mustache wax and their shaving soap for a number of years now, and I felt like Brandon, where's my beard oil? And so on my last order, I got some. It's good, but it's no Men of the Beard. Let's put it that way. Virgil Cain, the official rye whiskey of our podcast. Four Saints Brewing Company in Asheboro also hosts our Drinking Religiously once a month. We'll be there in a couple weeks, February 11th, if you want to join us at 6 o'clock for great beer, great people, and great conversation. Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, the premier lounge in Winston-Salem.
Without a doubt.
True that.
And you're going to be there Sunday, aren't you?
I'm planning on being there Sunday for the Super Bowl smokeout. It's going to be Sunday from 5 to 10:30 p.m. Mm-hmm. And it's Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, 1411 West 1st Street in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And as usual, I'm sure they'll have great deals on cigars. They'll have drinks, snacks, and raffles, which means I'm going to win something that Stacy's going to like guilt trip me into giving her. Mm-hmm. The last raffle I won where she looked at me like, you know you're going to give me this, but that still made her wait like a month and a half.
Aw.
It had a skull on it. Cutter.
Well, she had to have it.
I've had a V cutter. It loses its magic the second time you try to use it. It's like, this is so clumsy in your hand. So it's too much.
Yeah, but it's a nice cut.
Right. But
especially if you're cutter challenged and take off more of the cap than you should.
The paleo, man, I'm telling you. I was so good I had two of them. And I think I lost that one. I lost one of them at Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, the premier cigar lounge in Winston-Salem.
And we're also sponsored by Imagine That, where you go for all of your crafted needs, especially if you're clergy.
And she's opening an Etsy site now.
And she's going to be doing like live shows or something on Facebook. She's got a lot going on. Yeah.
I feel there's an obscene joke that could be made there, but you know what? I'm not going to go there tonight. It's too early.
Okay, let's wait. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Right.
It's now later.
Not tonight.
Not tonight. Okay. We're going to be nice to Imagine That. Be nice to Natalie.
She does good. How can you not be, man? She made like the
snappy. She made the most gorgeous stole for right. for Rev Helena's.
And I added
officially ordained.
I added pics both to our charlesandchris.net site. There is an album of just a few pics from Helena's ordination service, and I think with our last podcast, I posted a few as well. Mm-hmm. But so episode 106.
Okay.
Wait, unless this is 106, I forget.
No, this is 107.
Right.
See, two of us are keeping track.
Right. Well,
mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to the serious stuff. Chris, what are you smoking?
Well, actually, it's what I smoked last week. And I still don't realize
how this works. We have 107 episodes, and you still don't realize no one can see you. And if all you said is, well, I am smoking and gave you a review, no one would know.
I would know.
He would know.
I would know.
Okay. Well, hold that for our topic tonight.
Okay, so after a rough week in the world of chaplaincy, I went and had some Salvation there at Top Leaf last Friday. Picked up the new Rocky Patel, which I've never said, oh, I'm excited to smoke some of his sticks. But JD said it's really good, and yeah. He's heard nothing but good things about it. But it needed some rest, and I picked up a Viaje. But I had the Black Label Cigar Company's Salvation, which I've had before, mm-hmm. and it's... I needed something that just had that sort of sacrilegiousness to it, along with an Ecuadorian sun-grown Habano wrapper, Honduran binder, and Nicaragua filler. And it's just, it's so good. Cream, caramel, milk chocolate, vanilla, butter, some toasts and nuts, some wood notes, and some leather. I've had some in the past that had a kind of fruity notes to it, but this one was all... well, not fruity. So there. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was good. And it was salve on my soul since, you know, my former ex-work wife could be there, but the Jew was staying warm, staying infinitely drier in Greensboro. So, yeah.
Yeah.
We smoked without you.
It was a long week. And
right.
And it was Shabbos. And
it was Shabbos, even though my wife wasn't home for Shabbos. She'll be home for Shabbos this week, though.
Can you self nice. Shabbos? Because I've been doing that since like middle school. Does it count twice?
Yeah, but that's only once. Helena, what are you smoking?
So that's the problem is I don't know. I know I had a Viaje on Friday, but I don't know what kind. So I don't know that I can give a proper review. So sorry about that.
Okay. I know. One of the white label. It's just, it's not one of their specialty lines, but it's... God, we got it at the Viaje party they threw, Charles.
Right.
And it was a four pack, and unfortunately they all have the same wrapper on them. And
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Same label, I'm not sure. I can't really give it a proper review.
It's Viaje. There was definitely spice and pepper.
There was spice and pepper, and it was fairly medium bodied. Like it was.
Yeah. Other than the zombie line and the sure shot, which everybody thinks that's the only thing he makes. Viaje makes a whole variety of cigars, and a lot of them are in the medium range.
But if you've had the Sure Shot, I mean, it's...
Oh, but that's excellent, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, it's more to the full side. But a lot of people only smoke those, and they don't realize that there's so many other good Viajes.
Avoid the antidote. I get told zombie theme, but I wasn't as impressed with that as I was the shotgun shell-sized Sure Shots.
Yeah.
The Christmas blend.
Bills are good for the full body.
What did we do last one Thanksgiving? The stuffed turkey.
Yep.
Yeah. What was that?
It's all Viaje. They always come up with these kind of playful names. They do the little monsters. Is it them that do little?
No, that's Tetuaje does.
Tetuaje. Okay, I knew that.
Pudgy monsters and skinny monsters. Yeah.
Yeah. Different brand. I thought. Anyway.
Anyway.
Well, anyways, this one didn't have any fun label to guide me in looking up the contents of the cigar.
Was I not fun enough? I mean,
you're plenty fun, but you didn't help direct me towards a cigar review.
What good are you now?
Shame.
And you wonder why she's an ex-work wife.
I was right? So near. I was on the cusp of rage smoking that day. So
you were. It's true.
I will never outdo Helena, who put down two rather sizable cigars in one sitting, and we weren't there more than 2 hours.
No, I was. That was rage smoking.
And then on the way out to the car, I had a cigarette. Fuck.
I mean,
and probably four on her way home.
I don't drink. I don't do any other recreational drugs.
Don't tobacco. Drink, don't smoke. What do you do?
What do you do?
Yes.
I was thinking adamant.
Little adamant there for you. For you children. That's before your time. I am running with the bulls.
You dick. What in the hell have you done to deserve the Andalusian bull this evening?
I walked into Pipe and Pint, and they actually had 3 Andalusian bulls.
Do they still have 3, or did you take all the bulls?
No, I took all. What, are you crazy? I took all 3.
I think I still have one in one of my humidors.
So I am enjoying that with that lovely Ecuadorian Corojo, Dominican binder and filler that includes Criollo 98 and Piloto, white pepper, tobacco, little kind of Cinnamon Graham cracker sweetness to it.
Did you say Lindsey Graham sweetness to it?
Graham cracker.
Okay. Sorry. Clearly, mistake.
Lindsey Graham cracker, same thing. And what I love about this is I finally saw Cigar Cube really hit it on the head, because the tobacco flavor, that natural tobacco, in a lot of cigars, it's kind of on the sweet side, but this has more of a tang to it, adding to the spiciness. And it's true. It's like mesquite smoke.
It's like 2.5 hour smoke, though.
Yeah, well, I started it a while ago. Don't worry, we'll be done before Duke tips off. We know that's what you live for this time of year. It's not for us.
I know.
For the Dukies.
I suffer through football with you.
Yes, you do. And I suffer through football with my teams.
Hey, Super Bowl's in Miami. I mean, it's kind of...
Yeah, I've been to a Super Bowl in Miami.
Do you have picks for that? Do you think you got to...
No. It was 1969. Jets beat the Colts.
I'm talking about this Super Bowl.
Oh, this Super Bowl. No, I'm not in Miami for this Super Bowl. I said I'm not there because I've already been to a Super Bowl in Miami.
They give you a ring for that?
No.
They did not. So who are you picking this weekend?
I'm picking a really fun game. I'd really love to see the Chiefs win, because Andy Reid
kid do you love the most?
Right, exactly. And this is their first time being there since 1970.
So 50 years.
Yeah, I think it would be awesome for them to win it. Yeah, I mean, the 49ers have been there, done that. Fun team to watch, great defense. But
I don't know who I'm pulling for.
I just think the Chiefs. All I know is it's not the Pats, and that makes me happy.
It's like this. We passed on picking Patrick Mahomes.
Yes, you
did. To take a quarterback from that great football-rich tradition school, Chapel Hill. Are you fucking kidding me?
Look at all the great quarterbacks that have come out of UNC.
Okay, guys. Cigars, whiskey, F-bombs, theology. Moving on from the sports ball.
Somebody's got somewhere to be tonight.
Wow.
Sorry,
wow.
Interrupt your toe cutting there.
You can see that?
Yes.
Yeah, the camera's on.
I think, you know, and we do record the video as well. We just post the audio. I think we're going to break precedent. Maybe we'll post this video.
She's like hipster Buddha on that couch. I'm going to go cut my toenails, but I'm going to talk shit to y'all for talking sports ball right before the Super Bowl.
Instead of flipping up the bird, she just stuck her big toe in the camera.
Well, last week was a cat running back and forth.
I mean, that could still happen.
Yeah, you never know. That's the unpredictability. That's what's so great about being unscripted.
Yeah, I totally
assume. You never know when the cat's going to jump on Helena's lap.
I totally assumed that the video was frozen on your side too, and figured, fuck it.
No, we can see everything you're doing.
Oh, now it's frozen.
Now it's frozen.
Take care of myself.
Either that or she is. All right, so getting into the theology. All right. So I was watching this really cute show out of Brazil.
You need a commercial break there, Chief.
All right, throw in a commercial break there, Chief.
Men of the Beard, Beard Oil. Men of the Beard is a celebration of men's facial hair. Whether you've got a mustache, a goatee, a week's growth, or working on your yeard, they want you to celebrate what you've got and give you the tools to make it the best it can be. All of their beard care products are artisan crafted and hand poured. They intentionally source all of their ingredients from small businesses whose agricultural practices are both ethical and sustainable. All of their beard care products are vegan friendly. What does that mean to you? It means you're getting a high quality, all natural product that will be here for a long time to come, because they believe not raping our planet is a real good thing. Men of the Beard, Beard Oil.
Okay.
Okay.
Are we back now?
We're back now. Anyway, as we were saying before the break, before we were interrupting the break, that was watching this really cute show on Netflix from Brazil. Nobody's Looking. No one was looking at me, but nobody was looking at the name of the show. Really
so
cute.
Oh, my gosh.
So nicely done about these guardian angels and the randomness of the world. And this one angel.
Proving Methodism is what it's going to be like in heaven. It's just one big bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Was that heaven?
And all the angels are dressed as Mormons, but they're all gingers, which makes sense because angels don't have souls.
True. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were not created.
So the premise of this is, you know, do you have to follow the rules and what happens
in the absence of a god?
They find out that there really isn't a god. It's just some machine run by a hamster and a wheel. And
oh my hamster!
Oh my hamster!
Hashtag,
which apparently hamster in Portuguese is still hamster. It's just like hamster or something.
Hamster damn. Right.
There we go. There's our first hashtag.
What, Hamsterdam?
Hamsterdam.
You know there's some kind of weird sex club in Holland with that name.
Oh god, right? Have you ever seen that episode of South Park?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Yes. The hamster that goes on the quest.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh my god, I still can't watch that.
Inside Mr. Slave's Colon.
Yes.
Oh, that's such a wonderful one.
Another podcast that proves yet again Charles is a 13-year-old boy trapped in a man's body.
So what's that make me, like a 13-year-old boy trapped in a middle-aged woman's body? Yep.
Who was sitting in the lotus position after clipping her toenails.
So this got me thinking of an interesting thought experiment for us, because three of the angels, the main characters, represent three different ways of dealing with this. So putting it in a general thing, a comment here. So if after your lifetime of following the rules, you've been a rule follower all this time, and you've been told that it's important to follow the rules because if you don't, you're going to get punished. But then you suddenly learn that there is actually no one keeping score. No one's preparing a reward for rule following, nor is there punishment for rule breaking. What would you do? Would you continue to follow the rules just in case there might be someone keeping score that you don't know about? So one of the angels insists that, well, yes, we don't see that there's a God here, but we still have to follow the rules because
there might be, they may be here. They might be here anyways.
Or would you say, fuck it, and do whatever you felt like doing, especially all those things you were told were against the rules? So all the things you wanted to try that everyone said, oh, don't do that, it's against the rules, you'll get punished. You just say, what the hell, I'm going for it, and you're doing it, which was one of the other angels' responses. Or would you insist that there still be rules, but they should be rules that are based on logic, and we should follow them because they make sense, not because someone told us to follow them?
Which the show hints at, but doesn't. I don't recall a character particularly.
Well, that's kind of.
Dude,
kind
what are
of,
you talking about?
That's Uli. Ulysses. That's Uli's point.
Yeah, Uli's like.
Is that
like,
no? We still need rules, but we need rules that we can follow.
Rules
not
are
because
to be like moral, a moral compass.
Right, trying to eliminate the randomness of life. So yeah, he's more like, let's do this because this makes sense and keeps things running, not because someone said we had to follow the rule.
Mm-hmm.
So I put it to you two to begin. Which of those would you do?
I think I've done all of those at one time.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, right. I mean, I've mostly fallen into the fuck it category, but I've tried to pull it together a little bit over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years.
Well, it's kind of like what's the stuff we talk about where it's, you have like learn and you can point to a text or a lesson, theology, and then that which is kind of ingrained and you don't really realize that you're acting on, but it's there anyway. Mm-hmm. And I forget the distinction. So I came up with a thought when Charles did this, because really, you watched the show, it was really fun, but you don't have to have watched it to really get into this podcast. So I, for whatever reason, thought of this quote that I had to double check, because the first time I heard it, it was the original Crow movie, one with Brandon, the only decent Crow movie. Just save yourself the trouble with the sequels. It's one miscarriage after another. But Eric Draven, the lead character, says a piece to one of the people he saves, I guess, in a way of speaking, that was originally said by William Thackeray, which is, "Mother is the name for God in the lips and hearts of little children." And I started thinking about that because I think how we have experienced authority in our life colors, by and large, that sort of ingrained theology, or that we can't point to a formal learning. It's just always been there. Because there's a part of me that would go with the fuck it, because I had a very abusive and often very neglectful experience with my parents. And so now that I don't have to be afraid of them anymore, and then the parallel being I'm no longer afraid of God. So, but, and I think that that's, you know, that can be a jumping off point for a number of things, but I think that's probably an experience that most people have. Mm-hmm. You know, what is your conception of God and where did that come from? You know, I can point, like I said, to, well, this class or this book, but at the end of the day, I have to also point to that a lot of that was formed before I could read books or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it stays with you more than you realize, than I realized.
That's an interesting perspective, even like linking it to the show, right? Because the main character who kind of like snowballs all of this is a newborn, right? He doesn't have any concept outside of what he's been told, and through just asking some pretty basic questions, identifies pretty quickly that what he's being told and what reality is aren't matching up, right?
Yeah.
So he start, right? And that happens, I think, a lot in our form. I was saying, you're told that this is the way the world is, this is the way the world should be, and yet experientially, very different. And I think that that's true even right for our childhoods. I think you're making a good point, Chris, that our fundamental understanding of morality and right and wrong and how we should be in the world and how structured or unstructured that is has a lot to do with our formative attachments, right? And that's really, right, to me, like, what, so for me, when I say like the last 7 or 8 years, like I've tried to do it differently, that's because in some ways I've tried to remold my understanding of attachment through my relationship with God, right? That's a secure attachment for me. So it's not so much about punishment. It's about how do you behave correctly in the world in a way that supports other people and supports my own health, right? Does that make sense?
No, it does.
Yeah.
So that's what I was kind of reflecting on, like, through the show. And that fuck it thing, right? Like, it, both the fuck it and the, like, clinging to rigid rules are both kind of a lack of security, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and with the Gospels, even. And this, I'm going to say it, and I know Charles will have the rebuttal, which is very well put, but we often associate that, and exegetically wrong, with being Pharisaic in our beliefs. Well, the rules say it. And it's right. Like, yeah, but that's, the rules weren't written. The rules were written with a heart and an intent.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that if you lose sight of the intent, then you've lost really the reason that rules or whatever you want to call them, commandments, laws were even written. I mean, you still have to go back to that. What is it? The Talmud on the Torah on one foot,
right? Entirety of Torah. What is hurtful to you, do not do to others. The rest is all commentary. Learn. Yeah.
And I thought of another quote, and it, I think it fits in here. And Helena will like this. I know she likes this quote. A great woman, saint of Sufism, was seen running through the streets of her hometown, Basra, carrying a torch in one hand and a bucket of water in the other. When somebody asked her what she was doing, she said, "I'm going to take this bucket of water and pour it on the flames of hell, and I'm going to use the torch to burn down the gates of heaven so that people will not love God for want of heaven or fear of hell, but because God is God."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it kind of, that would be the more formal theological type statement. But it still goes back to the experience of those primary formative experiences of authority.
Yeah. And I think a lot of those are reinforced when you look at ritual worship and prayer, so many times the idea of God as Father, as King, you know, as ruler, as not just the giver of laws, but also the person who enforces them. So, you know, that transfer is very easy, can be very easily made, mm-hmm. right? From the familial attachment to the divine attachment.
Yeah, I could say my own experience with the coming to the very healthy, I'm going to say this and maybe regret it, the very healthy theological stance of fuck it, was my third and so far final thus far hospitalization. You know, I'm sitting in my room, I'm unable to sleep, unable to eat, you know, took very little to drink, just existing, just terrified of my own thoughts. And I was like, God, why aren't you going to step in and fix this? I've done all the, I followed all the rules. Where's the, you know, and that feeling that I didn't see a hamster. I guess it's more like the scene in Cool Hand Luke when he's in the church.
Yeah.
And, you know, love me, leave me, you know, hit me something. And, right. You know, that's what I thought.
Just let me know you're there.
Just me talking in the dark.
And you have, you know, one of the human characters that our angels encounter expresses that same thing when they tell her she's got an aneurysm and she's got months to live. Mm-hmm. She said we didn't see her with her daughter gone. You know, I followed all the rules. I went to church. I did everything the doctors told me. And now I'm still going to die. So fuck it. I'm going to go out in the blaze of glory.
I did not screw the gardener.
Yeah. And maybe she should have. Maybe her husband should have. At the same time.
Yep.
Much to the shock of her daughter.
Yep.
Yeah. And it can also be discussed not just in the divine sense or theological sense, because even people who don't believe in God, if you look at more philosophy, again, there's these laws, and you look at theology and then you look at moral philosophy. So even the idea of these are ways you're supposed to live and have morals and ethics, even if they don't come from a God, a lot of times it's the same kind of thing, where you've had philosophers are like, well, yes, we have this social contract, and so we have to be good to each other, or, well, you know, there's really nothing, so it doesn't really matter, or, you know, yes, we have nothing, so it matters even more. So, you know, it's not just an issue for, you know, attachment to it, God said so. And it's also, as you've pointed out, you know, has a very practical. Yeah, why should I do this? Because I'm your mother and I said so.
There's a certain point where that answer isn't sufficient.
Exactly.
And without that answer, you never get to become an adult.
Right.
I mean, you can make the argument we're always children of God, but that's sort of a cop-out.
Right.
I mean, that answer is like loses its efficacy pretty early, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Like early.
Well, not always for people. It's why, like Chris is talking about, how that can very easily then get transfer to other authority figures.
Do either of you like
people who just spend their whole life following rules?
Go ahead.
I'm just curious, like, if either of you have a memory of a point in time when you realized that the rules were either unfair or arbitrary.
Ooh.
Oh, very, very young, because though he doubts it very seriously, my father raised his children to be cynics mm-hmm. and to question everything.
Mm-hmm.
He did a great job.
Yeah. And that you always wanted a reason why you were told to do something. And you may still have to do it, but you didn't just do it because someone told you.
See, I don't remember the curiosity. Mine was the fear of even asking the question.
Mm. Yeah,
because the response was going to be arbitrary and violent most of the time. Or, you know, it was going to be because I said so. And, you know, I think when somebody loves you, you can take the because I said so a lot differently when you really just have no reason to feel secure, or that there's not something else going on that I need to be worried about. And, you know, and people could probably listen to this podcast and, oh, you all got daddy, mommy issues, but
fuck yeah,
everybody does.
Everybody does.
Even so, Jesus. I mean, for just like, dad, seriously, let this cup pass. I mean, think of that Old Testament. Isaac's like, yeah, Abraham, you try that shit again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Kierkegaard, fear and trembling. Kierkegaard made a whole book about that shit.
Mm-hmm.
No, mine's really like really lighthearted, but it was really serious. Like in terms, like, I was three. I remember being three, and this is the first. And I was playing house with a girlfriend, and she said she was going to cut my hair with these ducky shears, right? These little pinking shears shaped like ducks. And we were playing, so I thought she was going to play cut my hair. Well, that didn't happen. She for real cut all my hair off. And I remember getting in a lot of trouble and insisting that I hadn't done anything wrong because I didn't know that she was going to actually cut my hair. So why was I being punished, right? And like that, like I said, it's really silly. It's kind of a cute story. But at three, I remember being like, this is unjust. Like, this is unfair. And the rules don't apply, like in this case, right? Like these weird little moments we have as children that stick. I mean, and I wouldn't go so far as to say that that's colored my idea of authority. I think plenty of other things have done that over the years, but.
But it captures a dimension of it. It really does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I've got. Go ahead.
Where that like black and white thinking just doesn't work in our reality. That's all.
Yeah. So I got educated out of that very, very early in my family. Yeah. My parents told us, yes. If we said, well, that's really arbitrary. And they were like, yes. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Sometimes the rules are really arbitrary, but you have to deal with that. And So I the most humorous story I can tell is, so by the time I reached high school, I was very good at when people said, you have to do this, I would say, why?
Mm-hmm.
And I would do it politely and say, I'm not saying that I'm not going to do what you asked me to do, but I just want a reason why. And if you give me a good reason, I'll do it. And most of the teachers were pretty okay with that, but the head of the school hated it because he had spent his whole life telling people what to do and they did it. And I would always go, okay, but why? It's like, well, because that's what we do here. Like, that's not a good reason. Give me a good reason. Mm-hmm. And someone would step in and give me a reason, and I'd do it. At graduation, they call my name. I walk across the stage. He hands me my high school diploma, shakes my hand, and says, in 25 years, I've never said this to a student, but I am damn glad to be getting rid of you.
Thorn in his side.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm a little bit different. I don't need you to tell me why. I need to figure out the intrinsic value for me to do it. I don't really give a shit why you think I need to do something. Mm-hmm. Right? So right. In that, like, if I can identify an intrinsic value in following a rule, then I'll follow it. If I can't, I usually won't, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most rules then I follow because intrinsically most rules are there for cohesiveness, right? Culturally,
yeah,
and relationally. And that's of high value to me. But if I can't identify anything of value in a rule, I'm usually pretty willing to disregard it, no matter what someone else's external rationale for it is.
Right. Well, yeah. It's not that I did that with every rule. I'm with you. There are rules that we just understand are necessary for a functioning society. It's right. When I was presented with those seemingly totally arbitrary ones, and it was more of a challenge of, well, if you can't show me that following this rule benefits me or somebody else other than just you, like why I need to take this class and not that class, why I need to have my locker on that side of the hallway instead of another side of the hallway. You're not my mother, so you can't say because I'm the principal and I said so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to know that you have thought this out and that
right.
You have this rule because it's better for everyone if we follow this rule.
But how many people, especially with Christianity, because we're not a faith that we say we're open to questions, but that's bullshit. Most clergy are farly ill-prepared. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's like, well, this is just the rules. Like, well, why do we have it? And there is fruit in questioning it. I mean, that's why my denomination is splitting open, because the rule doesn't make any damn sense. So here's a fear of mine, and it's been a fear of mine for ages, likely since I decided I want to be a minister, is, I really resonated with the character Fred, which I hated to say that Fred, I get Fred, where he's having to like, well, this is just the way it's done, Because he sounds like every parishioner, like, what's tradition? Well, why? Oh, I don't know. We've just always done it that way. But I've wondered if at some level, being a pastor is just being a really good bullshit artist. You know, because what do you do when your faith doesn't really encourage you, and even your polity doesn't? When the prisoner comes in, and why is my husband dying at, you know, 30 years old, and, you know, what's God's plan, or any of those kind of deep, dark, black hole like questions. And I noticed early on as a pastor is I felt the need that God needed a lawyer, even though I wasn't hired or retained. I think chaplaincy training, one way or the other, beats that out of you.
But
if there is that fear of, you know, I know that you, well, and you see it in the show when the, you know, Yuli's just like, well, it's just a hamster. You know, we're not real. And how fucking devastating that is.
Mm-hmm.
Like every time somebody's, and I don't want to say illusion because it sounds so negative, but illusion, for lack of a better word, gets, that bubble gets burst. It's tragic. I mean, you can feel their pain just watching it, even though it's a dark comedy. But, you know, it's hard, though, when you're a pastor and a chaplain, you know, in any kind of caring like that, where somebody's asking you a question that, honestly, you don't have a good answer for.
Right.
But you know that they need to know the hamster's on the wheel, but not know that it's a hamster.
Well, in some ways, people need to be able to, like, and I don't know how we do this in church. In chaplaincy, like you said, there's kind of a more intimate opportunity because you tend to be meeting people in existential crises, right? But to develop, we talk about developing second naivete in regards to scripture, right? But to develop that even in regards to like the rules of the faith system, right? That there's this moment where the veil drops and it all looks arbitrary and like bullshit, but then you're able to build back up into what is the functionality of these rules? What is the broader purpose, the broader and that's kind of what they go through, like the arc of that show, right? Like,
right.
They kind of come through this like, oh, right, like they're devastated. And I don't want to give too much away because people really should just
I don't think it will. I mean, so far, I'm not hearing any good spoilers.
But like, you know, there's that devastation when they first discover what they discover. And then through that arc and through that process of trying to reconcile, right, they come through to a space where they're like, oh, actually, there is this functionality, not necessarily to the system as it was, but to a system, right? Like similar. Right. And I wonder like how we kind of coach people, or not coach, but like support people through that development on their own. Because I think that's why so many people leave or don't engage with structural institutions generally, not just church, right? Because that veil drops and they never re-engage to discover what deeper.
It's fear of the pain.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
I think. I mean,
what do they say in The Princess Bride? Like,
life is pain.
Life is pain.
Anybody telling you anything different is selling something.
Selling you something.
Yeah. And it's also, I go back to, I know you apologize for using the term Pharisee, because they get blamed for this a lot.
Right, right.
But it is this, I think, Christian-Jewish division that, you know, because I'm in the beginning of Daf Yomi, which is a 7.5-year cycle of reading a page of Talmud a day. And that's another podcast, and we could have some people on because it's really fascinating. And we're starting with the first book, which is Barachot, which is all about prayers. But it's things like today was, okay, so if there's shit on the ground, can you say the Shema? Or how far away do you have it to be? Or what happens if you have to go to the bathroom and you have to fill it on? And, you know, is it okay once the first turd drops? And that's the term that the first mass is how the rabbi said it. You know, can you now continue praying? So like if you're praying and you suddenly have to go to the bathroom, you know, can you do it? So, I mean, deep, deep discussions of you know, how far or close can you be to a turd and what condition can it be in? And on the surface, yes, it looks like really, really legalistic. But when you read it and keep reading it and you follow the discussion, it's about, well, how do we accommodate this rule that we have to say this prayer while at the same time being human and like living having our to lives. Take a dump. Mm-hmm. You know, so they thought of every possible scenario and figured out whether or not that was okay to still say this prayer. And because of that, you know, even though there's all these rules, it comes with in Judaism the tradition of, well, we've got to question it. And you get contradictory answers. Some rabbis said, no, you can't. Others said, yes, you can. Others said, you can if you do this. And they're all recorded. Mm-hmm. And we get everybody's thing. So the first thing you see is the rabbis were questioning all of this, even themselves. And at the end of some of these arguments, the Talmud says, and the Gemara said it was a contradiction.
But see, that's the difference between
Jews right. And so I think that in, you know, it's not that all Jews are like this because we're human beings and, you know, we follow rules to follow rules, but there's more of this tradition of questioning them. And I think that because Christianity was trying to separate itself, maybe part of this reason why, well, we're not going to get into all these. Well, what about this? What about
or just,
this?
Or just
what about Jesus, that? What about this?
Jesus calling back to the heart of the Torah is, you know, to do unto others as you would want to be done unto.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that at some point, though, that got overclouded. It still is. Yeah. Because it's like, you know, you see the memes, like, remind me again who I told you to hate. You know, it's the of course, always the white Jesus, you know, Sermon on the Mount kind of vibe. So I was thinking about, like, how do I deal with that, like, practically?
Right.
After unloading all that about, you know, is something that Charles said, but Shakespeare did. But, you know, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Yep.
Would it have replaced the hamster or the parent for me is something that, you know, I will say that was my formal theological training. Oh, but it's going back to, you know, can you embrace the mystery?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And just have the confidence that there are some things that I don't know why, but those little moments where my heart's still touched, I'm still moved in ways that, you know, cognitively speaking, I can't explain. Mm-hmm. But it's just the experience of the unknown or the mystery.
Well, and you know, I'm having this thought, which is kind of a strange thought for me to have, considering, like I said, my general lack of interest in quote unquote like authority. But I have to wonder, like, you know, when people say, well, this is the way we do things because this is the way they've always been done, like, we tend to look at that skeptically or cynically, right?
Yeah, it's a lousy reason.
It's a lousy reason, but maybe in some ways it's not. Like, maybe in some ways there needs to be an acknowledgement that the way that these things have been done have been supportive for people through the years. Not all of them. I'm just saying, like, not throwing the whole baby out with the bathwater, right? Like,
but it doesn't mean the bathwater don't need to be changed and warmed up and cleaned.
Right, and cleaned. But, like, that there is
or something. Maybe you need to take a shower instead.
Right.
Maybe, but, like, that there is something to the ways in which the rules and structures that are applied to our lives have been supportive of other people in the past, and that's why they've been passed forward.
Yes. But what you've expressed is still an understanding of the structure. And to me, that's what I was trained to question, right? Not question it to reject it, but, okay, this is how we've always done it. Well, why? Has it always worked? Is it the best way? Well, it was 3,000 years ago.
When you were talking about
that. Do we need to adapt it? Do we need to change it?
No, I don't. No, like I said, Charles, I prefaced it by saying that obviously you don't just accept things as they are willy-nilly. But that I think that especially, and I'm going to use this word, especially in the postmodern kind of era that we're in, the assumption is that everything needs to be deconstructed, but then we don't reconstruct.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Or we try to reconstruct in ways that are totally alien or foreign to people that they can't connect with because they can't recognize the bones of what used to be there anymore.
Well, postmodernism I always thought was a posture and not much of a movement.
Well, but it's constantly definitely, like, but the ethos is there.
No, it's there. No, postmodernism is misunderstood and most people use it as a pose. And I totally agree with Helena that people use the word deconstruction when they mean destruction.
Yeah.
And they just want to tear shit down.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no intentionality. It's not an optimistic way of approaching something, right? People don't go into these structures that have, and I'm not arguing that they haven't been damaging at all, but they go into these structures assuming that there's nothing of value there.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And then strip it bare and say, see, I told you there's nothing of value there, and leave it behind.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas, I don't know that that's true. I think people really, really need some of that in their lives in order to feel secure, right?
Oh, yeah, going back to
childhood, right? Like children that are raised without rules, without parameters and boundaries are totally fucked when they're older because they can't figure out what's healthy and what's not.
Yeah. And that's, I was just in my way agreeing and trying to expand.
Yeah, no, I understand
what you were saying, and that's the pose that Yuli, our main character in this show, that prompted all this. That's his point. And, you know, his point is yes, well, we need structure, but that structure's got to be based on something,
right?
You know,
right.
I think it was great what you pointed out. You know, he's like a child who, you know, has never seen all these structures, and so he doesn't know, but he's trying to deconstruct, because deconstruction, you're supposed to take it apart to find the value, mm-hmm. not show there is none.
Right.
Yeah, find the value, and then that value, you put it back together in a way where that value is now more prominent.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the reconstruction, if it has no value, I mean, I'm just aware that I don't think anybody can flourish under a despot or an anarchist.
Right.
Right.
Well, again, they're extremes. And
so when you were talking about that, the first thing I thought of was Passover meals at your house. Mm-hmm. Why do we do this on this night? You know, and
right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's something to be said for faith communities that ritual, liturgy, at least liturgy in the sense of that's being passed down, less the work of the people necessarily. But that's an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more going on than, well, because on this night we eat unleavened bread, you know. Right.
Well, but the thing you've got to remember,
or this is my blood, this is my body,
right, mm-hmm. is that, yes, on Passover we ask that question, why on this night do we do this when we don't do it other nights? We then give an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that answer is because this is what God did for me and my ancestors. And we say it in the present tense. We don't say, this is what God did for my ancestors millennia ago. I said, this is what God did for me, and that's why I'm doing this ritual. So I think,
oh, did Charles almost, that was almost sacramental sound.
Well,
did you pick up on that, Elena?
But it's I'm not a total atheist.
He's gonna start wanting grape juice and Hawaiian bread now.
Oh, that's
no,
a good combo.
I'm happy with my wine and Jew crackers, thank you.
my Jew crackers.
Where the Jew crackers?
And my four cups of wine. I guess the way to put it is that the questioning's good if only the question then leads to an answer and understanding.
Hmm.
Or if it can't, then at least as clergy, I'm thinking just a willingness to journey with you.
Yeah.
You know.
Dude, I don't know why this just popped into my head, and there's like no. But I was in a context recently where someone very, very earnestly meant this when they said it, that there is no reason to ever ask why.
Wow. Well, yeah, now I just want to
ask. Did you immediately ask them why?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't a context where I could crosstalk. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
But they meant it, because from their perspective, asking why leads to answers that you can't do anything about anyways, and you just have to be present with what is. It doesn't matter why.
Yeah, that's
why is the most important question.
Well, I happen to agree, but this is someone who, you know, I respect and who has done a lot of work, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she was really, really earnest about that.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. I definitely am not on the same page, but there are people in this world that really believe that why is not a productive question.
And I can see your point in that, you know, wanting to protect people from struggle and doubt and pain.
Right.
But on the other hand, isn't that what life is? Isn't, aren't we
just
supposed
doubt and
to?
Pain?
No, but it is uncertainty and randomness and all these things
so I think
that you have to struggle with, and that's what makes it worthwhile.
Well, I think her point is that those things are going to happen anyways.
Oh, okay.
But I get the feeling this person at least had the privilege of asking why, and somebody took that person seriously.
Yeah, probably so. Anyways, like I said, it's kind of an aside. What?
You see it in the show that we're talking, kind of basing this off of. It's just how destructive, when you can't answer the why, you tell them, people just need the why to exist, or at least the question, and mm-hmm. the answer is irrelevant, or at least not the driving concern of their faith, belief, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not asking why, are we protecting the person asking, or are we protecting the person who's being asked? Mm. Well, if nobody asks me why, then I don't have to tell them I don't know. And I had a mentor who said the three most important words any teacher can say is, I don't know. Sharing with your students, I'm not the font of all knowledge. I'm in this journey with you together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the rest of Hillel's quote, right? It's all commentary. Go learn. We're supposed to all be in this process together. Hillel wasn't saying, well, I know the answer, but I'm not going to tell you. You go figure it out and then come back to me. It was, yeah, I'm learning too. You know, that's what I mean by, you know, that's life, is acknowledging that, yeah, we're all questioning, we're all seeking answers, and we don't always get them, but we're in this learning together.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna move to words of wisdom, if you don't mind.
Why? Sorry. That's channeling my inner nephew.
Because that's what we've done 106 times in the past.
Why?
Because. And so words of wisdom, and as always, they're randomly chosen with no connection to anything we've been talking about.
No thought into it at all.
No consideration.
None at all.
Willy-nilly.
Yep.
Hamster lottery balls.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. So only because the day we're recording is the yahrzeit for one of my favorite authors, Zora Neale Hurston, whom if you haven't, you must read. She is brilliant. And this is something that she said. It seems to me to be true that heavens are placed in the sky because it is the unreachable. The unreachable, and therefore the unknowable, always seems divine. Hence, religion. People need religion because the great masses fear life and its consequences. Its responsibilities weigh heavy. Feeling a weakness in the face of a great forces, men seek an alliance with omnipotence to bolster up their feeling of weakness, even though the omnipotence they rely upon is a creature of their own minds. It gives them a feeling of security.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
I'm Helena Epstein, and I'm still the ampersand of reason.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile
walk into a bar mitzvah.
Wishing I could change the things that I...
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire.
Give back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you gotta live with that. If you learn from your mistakes, you'll get a normal chance at that.